Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
I have no idea if Gene Sledge was a Toby Keith fan. But what you're going to hear next is a is part one of a two-part interview. You'll hear the second part tomorrow. But it is the famous American literary figure, broadcaster, Studs Terkel, who made his living in Chicago. And he went to Alabama to hear, to interview Gene Sledge as he was doing research on his book. And so just went down to have a conversation. Now, the book is called The Good War. And what Terkel seeks to do is dispel that myth by talking to everyday people and the perception that this was a good war, Terkel sought to dispel. So, anyway, without further ado, this is Studs Terkel, and it is Eugene Sledge. And I listened to it yesterday, and it is an absolutely wonderful interview because you get a sense of the kind of man Gene Sledge is in long format. The longest clips I've found on the internet are maybe 5-minute clips, which is very frustrating because you can... You know, his articulate nature, his deep experiences, obviously the amount of time that Gene Sledge thought about that stuff, all that contribute to his voice. So it's my privilege here on a Monday to host a conversation between Studs Terkel and Gene Sledge, because Gene Sledge is a part of post-traumatic winning. And I see the video of him trying to go hunting with his dad. And I will put the clip in of that scene so that you can see it. His life has changed forever by the experience. And again, when you see the clip of he essentially has a panic attack when he's gonna go hunting with his father. He doesn't want to tell his father he doesn't want to go, so he's gonna fake it. And you'll see him have a panic attack. And I show that every time I do post-traumatic winning. And I say, this is what we're trying to fake. In fact, it just played in the commercial for this break. But when you hear that commercial that says, you know, I'm good, but I can't sleep at night. I'm good, but I feel alone. I'm good, right? But it's hard for me to be in groups. When you hear that commercial, I say, this is what faking it. I say three things. This is what faking it looks like. And then I put up the billboard for the 800 number. I say, this is where faking it takes you. Here's the billboard for the 800 number. We so don't know you. You're so alone. Please call an 800 number before you kill yourself. This is what faking it sounds like. And I play that audio. I'm good, but. And I said, and this is what faking it looks like. And I kind of set up the scene, you know, that I just kind of discussed with you, where Gene Sledge is going to try to fake it, doesn't want to go hunting. And what is he afraid of? He's afraid that if they shoot an animal and it's not a clean kill, the animal's going to thrash. And if the animal thrashes, what is he going to see? He's going to see all the video that he has stored in his head, and he doesn't want to see that. So Gene Sledge is part of post-traumatic winning, and I've got curious about his life. In particular, what I'm curious about and why I called his son on Friday and left a message is I'm curious about when he came home, because when you read about him, it says he writes with the old breed at the urging of his wife. So in the movie Pacific, they show him coming home and drinking and being despondent. So he goes on to become a botanist and a very successful one, a PhD teaching for the remainder of his life. And then he writes 25 years later, I think With the Old Breed is published. So anywho, or he begins writing it. So at the urging of his wife. So I'm curious about, that story, but I may never find out the truth. So, with all of that said, this is That Conversation.
As we're here talking, right this minute, are we registering now? I think it is, yeah. I simply want to say I'm seated here at the home of E.B. Sledge, Sledgehammer. And this is in Montevallo, I'd like him to describe it, Alabama. It's a very graciously appointed house, fireplace, he and his wife Jean and sons have looked here. But this is E.B. Sledge himself is very gentle of manner. But I didn't think that in reading his book at first, you see. He wrote a book. But before that, there's a plaque on the wall. And it has the patch, 1st Marine Division, the familiar patch, this Guadalcanal, presented to Eugene B. Sledge. And it reads, "We, the men of K Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Regiment, 1st Marine Division, do hereby proudly bestow," by the way, CO for company, BN for battalion, REG for regiment, "do hereby proudly bestow this testimonial in expression of our great admiration and heartfelt appreciation to one extraordinary Marine who has honored his comrades in arms by unveiling to the world their exploits and heroism in his authorship of With the Old Breed at Peleliu and Okinawa. God love you, Sledgehammer, 1982. So I was thinking, Sledge, I know you're called Sledge, but here you are, slim of build, gentle. You are professor of what at the University of Montevallo?
Well, I'm a biology professor, and I teach several courses, evolution, comparative anatomy, and ornithology, and history and philosophy of science. My main interest is ornithology, bird study. I've been interested in birds since I was a kid, and that's my main interest.
Where was that?
I grew up in Mobile, Alabama.
Interested in birds, and so I think of you and World War II and the Marine. I say World War II to you, because your world then has been, if I didn't know about your book and your exploits, I said, this gentle, nonviolent being. That's about a good description, isn't it?
Well, what do you mean? You think there's an irony there?
I don't know. I was asking, I would describe you as...
Oh, as, well, I said...
Is that a good description?
Well, I've never been put in jail for breaking the peace, anything like that. I suppose you'd call me nonviolent.
Yeah. Gentle.
Well, I hope so.
Well, what'd you say when you said just then, do I see an iron in?
Well, in the fact that I'm interested in birds and biological science and was a combat Marine on the front lines. It's amazing, Stud. You know, people tend to think of birds and bird watchers as being sort of, you know, as not quite macho, you know, and so forth. Because I think the ridiculous thing is there was nothing macho about the war at all. We were just a bunch of scared kids who had to do a job, and the reason we did it was because we were trained properly and we were patriotic. And that, I mean, you know, to me, there's no... People tell me, you know, you don't look or act like an ex-Marine. And I say, well, how's an ex-Marine supposed to act? And they have some Hollywood stereotype, you know. But the guys in my outfit, well, I think history proves were the best, or some of the best that were. All the six Marine divisions were good, but there were some real old-timers in my company from stretching way back to Nicaragua and that sort of thing. And we were just a bunch of kids that volunteered and went in, and because it was a total war. And these guys, their spirit rubbed off on us. And what we were in it for was to get it over with so we could get back home and then do what we wanted to do and lead our lives.
You said a bunch of scared kids. It's young kids.
Well, yeah, I was 19, and I think that the average age of... In the 1st Marine Division, when I went into it, it had been the Guadalcanal campaign and the Cape Gloucester campaign, and then I went into it as a replacement.
We're talking about what years, roughly, now?
Well, I went in the 1st Division in June of 1944. I had been through boot camp and infantry training. Of course, prior to that, I went into it overseas. It was overseas. It just had come off of Cape Gloucester. And the average age, I think, or 80% of the division was not 21 years old yet. So we were, compared to Army combat units, generally we were much younger.
Younger. You were 19.
Yeah.
You said a replacement division.
No, I was a replacement in the division, see, because they... After each campaign, they had to bring in replacements to make up for the casualties. And I went into my company.
Which were pretty heavy.
Well, they were heavy at Guadalcanal and not so heavy at Cape Gloucester. But then I went in as a replacement, and some of the Guadalcanal men rotated home. And then we hit Peleliu and were there 30 days, and my company had 65% casualties. Some of them had more casualties than mine did. But see, I think there's a point that I think you and I talked about it earlier, that there are really, to me, in a sense, there were two different wars, not just different theaters, but there was the war of the guy on the front lines. And that's what I just happened to have been, and my unit was one of those types. And we were on the front lines, and you didn't come off the front lines until your unit got relieved or until you got killed or wounded. And then there were all these support personnel who were necessary behind us. But in the public eye, everybody was in the service. He was in the war zone and all this. And one writer has shown that, one historian has shown that in the Pacific, for every one man on the front lines, one, every rifleman, and I was a rifleman and also a light infantry mortarman, which was right, just firing right over the lines, but for every one man on the line in the Pacific, there were 19 people in support positions. Mm-hmm. So you see, their view of the war was different from my view. And the journalists and the writers, in my view, very, very seldom give you the perspective of the man who was the participant on the line and had to put his life on the line day after day after day to the point of utter hopelessness. And this is the way it was for us. And the only thing that kept you going was your faith in your buddies. And that, you see, it was a strong Marine tradition, and I don't know about the other services, so I can't say, and I don't want to appear to be critical of them, but one of the strongest motivating factors we had in our training was you can't let another Marine down. You just can't let your buddy down. And it wasn't just a case of friendship, it was a case of, if this guy's a Marine, he is a guy that you can depend on, and he can depend on you. And so I've had fellows from other branches of the service write me and say, you know, you didn't mention in your book, you didn't mention self-inflicted wounds. You know, I saw this in Europe. Well, I never heard of it. Now, I must admit there were plenty of times that I wished I could have gotten $1 million wound, and I thought about maybe shooting a toe off or something like that, to be perfectly honest, but it was not... the worst thing, what was worse than death was the indignation of your buddies that you didn't measure up to what they were doing. And you couldn't let them down. And
this was even beyond this thing you're talking about, this not letting your buddy down and not losing your buddy's respect was perhaps even stronger than flag and country.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's true, because in essence, when... It seems to, in my opinion, after you'd been in combat a matter of, maybe just a few days, and at Peleliu, of course, it was 30 days and 30 nights, because of the Japanese, it was all night long, you know, infiltrating the lines and slipping up and throwing grenades and trying to come running in, you know, with a bayonet or a saber or something, and although they did not put any of those stupid bonsai charges on us at Peleliu, they pretty much stayed back in the caves and all. But they were active all night, and so it was, you know, all they could sleep was, your buddy would try to get a little cat nap, and you'd stay on watch, and then you'd switch off. And so it went on day in and day out, and nobody really talked about patriotism after. I mean, it was a matter of just simple survival, and the only way you could get it over with was to kill them off before they killed you off. And so patriotism probably is what motivated many of us to enlist, but when you get down to the real elemental aspects of it, what it was all about was just a matter of survival.
Yeah.
And the war that I knew was, I mean, it was totally savage and without quarter. I mean, there was no... we never took prisoners unless an officer made us take them.
Really?
Yeah. Because the hatred was so intense. Because you see, the Japanese fought by a code which they thought was right, which was the code of Bushido.
Bushido?
Yeah, Bushido.
Which meaning?
A code of the warrior.
Uh-huh.
And they would reach perfection through perfecting the art of being a warrior, you see. And so to them, it was no surrender, and this was, I mean, the papers talk about no surrender and this, that, and the other, but you don't really comprehend it until you get out there and fight people who are faced with an absolutely hopeless situation, and you got them cornered, but they will not give up.
And then, of course, there was this feeling, here these young kids, obviously unsophisticated, naive young kids who joined the Marines, you know, they're also scared. At the same time, don't let their buddy down. Something happens to them and their attitude toward the others, the Japanese. They develop a sort of hatred.
You mean the Japanese?
No, I mean, I'm talking about the American kids.
Oh, yeah, well, of course, if you tried to help wounded Japanese, they usually responded by detonating one of their grenades and would kill themselves, which is typically what they would try to do to prevent being captured, was to kill themselves if they were wounded.
Because capture was disgraceful.
Disgrace to them, yeah. And to us, of course, it was impossible because we all knew what had happened at Bataan.
Uh-huh.
So it was a no-quarter, savage kind of thing. I mean, you develop an attitude toward these people. I've heard of, where you had absolutely no mercy on them. And they had no mercy on us. And I must admit that at first, at Peleliu, for instance, the first time I was really close enough to any of them to see them and see their faces when they got hit and all that, because a lot of my buddies had been hit by that time, but it really bothered me. And the first time I had to see a Japanese get hit at first, and the first time I saw some of the guys field stripping them, as the term went, you know, while you went through the packs and the pockets for souvenirs and stuff, and the guys would drag them around just like a carcass, you know, and getting souvenirs off of them. And I was just horrified. You know, I was just amazed. These guys, they'd been human beings, you know. And my buddies were, because these buddies were veterans, you see. And I was a greenhorn, one of the greenhorns and recruits, so to speak. But it didn't take you long to overcome that, because after a while, I guess you could say the veneer of civilization sort of wore pretty thin. Mm. Because the fatigue and the stress, and I hear people talk about, well, they like this in athletics or that type of excitement and hunting and this, that, and the other, because the old adrenaline is flowing. Well, you know, after the adrenaline flows about a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, it's been shown biologically that you become physiologically exhausted. Mm-hmm. Just simply from being excited, and you might say revved up for so long. And of course, Okinawa was, it lasted 82 days.
You were in Okinawa too?
Yeah, Peleliu and Okinawa.
Yeah.
And at Okinawa, my company had over 100% casualties, and they brought replacements in, and the old guys would get hit, some of the new guys got hit, and so forth. But it didn't take you long. This attitude of hatred toward the Japanese was not a sort of a false macho type thing that we got from the veterans or were trying to act tough and things like that. It was just a natural feeling that developed. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, this was as, it seems to me, it was as elemental a matter of literally fighting for survival as anything could be. Because my brother was in Europe, and he was decorated. He was in a tank outfit attached to the 2nd Infantry Division, which was a very outstanding infantry division in the Army. And he was wounded 3 times. He was in the Battle of the Bulge and all this. But he said typically when things were hopeless for the Germans, they surrendered.
So it was different, was it not? And there was a different attitude toward the Germans than there was toward the Japanese.
Oh, absolutely. And I've seen guys shoot Japanese wounded when it really was not necessary, and knock gold teeth out of their mouths, because most of them had gold teeth, you know. Mm. I remember one time the first time at Peleliu, I thought, well, I'll teeth, because one of my buddies had he carried a bunch of them in a sock, what you did was you took your K-bars. Here's the one I carried through the wall.
K-bar.
Yeah, K-bar, fighting knife.
It's called K-bar.
It has a 7-inch seven-inch blade.
Wow.
And
K-bar, because
that's the company that built that made it.
Yeah.
And and
bar is has initials for something.
BAR.
Yeah.
Branding automatic rifle, but this
But
this is the name of the knife.
Yeah, knife. Yeah.
But we all had these, and at night you typically slept with it like this, you know. Because they would try to creep around the foxholes and all. But the way they extracted a gold tooth was to put the tip of the blade on the base of the tooth of the dead Japanese, and I've seen guys do it to wounded ones.
To wounded ones?
Yeah. That couldn't
rely on
it. Yeah, they couldn't resist. Yeah, you know. And put the tip of the blade on the base of the tooth and hit the the hilt of the knife to knock it loose. And
so you said,
I mean, this sounds unreal. How could American boys do that? And they could do it because they'd been reduced to savagery by a situation that was a matter of life or death for the Japanese and for us. And I saw Will Lindbergh made a trip to the Philippines, and he interviewed some Americans, and he was horrified at the way the American GIs, Army GIs, infantrymen, talked about the Japanese, you know, and the boys sounded so brutal and all. Well, I admire Colonel Lindbergh for his idealism, and he said, we're fighting for democracy, and these men talk like they're savages or something. He didn't say savages, but that's what we were. This is what you were reduced to in order to survive.
Even you, at that one time, you said,
well, yeah, I was going to get some gold teeth.
At the very beginning, yeah.
Yeah, at Peleliu, there was this Jap machine gun squad that had been knocked out by my company, and the nips, the ammo carriers and all were lying around, and I went up with my K-bar, and I leaned down to as the troops used to say, make the extraction of the prescribed manner. And this medical, we had Navy medical corpsmen as hospital, you know, medics, and Army called the Army medical people. But our Navy medical corpsmen were just phenomenal guys. They were wonderful. And just, oh my God, they were just so dedicated. And they had a terrific casualty rate. And, but anyway, this boy's name was Kent Caswell, and bless his soul, he's dead now. He died a few years ago, but he was from Texas. And Doc Caswell said, "Sledgehammer, what are you going to do?" And I said, "Doc, I'm going to get me some gold teeth." And he said, "Well, now, you don't want to do that. Don't do that." And I said, "Well, all the other guys are doing it, you know. And, hell, I've been cutting insignias off their collars for souvenirs and this kind of thing." And he says, "But don't take the gold teeth. What would your folks think?" I said, "Well, gosh, Doc, my dad is a medical doctor back in Mobile. He might think it's interesting, you know, if I had some jab gold teeth, you know." And he said, "Oh, Sledgehammer, you don't want to do that." And I said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Well, because of the germs. You know, you might get germs." And I said, "Well, I hadn't thought of that, Doc." Well, I hadn't had any biology at the time, and in retrospect, I realized that Kent Caswell wasn't worried about germs. He just didn't want to see me do that. Mm. Because, you know, it was just another step, you might say, toward just abandoning all concepts of decency. That
you see, what's great about you, Sledgehammer? What's moving about you is that you see the horror of it, in which you were part of, the young soldier, young Marine, and the other guys who were decent kids. But something that you point, one kid shooting pebbles into the skull.
Oh, yeah, the Jap machine gun.
Yeah.
Water had fallen into the skull.
And casually doing what? What was he doing?
Well, this Jap machine gunner was squatting down on the ground behind his heavy machine gun, and one of our Browning automatic riflemen had killed him and just took the top of his skull off with a blast of rifle fire and then killed the rest of the Jap ammo carriers. And it rained that night, and this Jap gunner didn't fall over. The ammo carriers were laid out on the ground, and so was the assistant gunner. But some odd reason, the gunner was sitting bolt upright behind the machine gun. You sat flat on your fanny with those things, and you put the feet forward, and it had a button triggers and two handles to aim it with. And his arms were down at his side because, of course, he was dead. But his eyes were wide open, and he was looking right down the barrel just like he was aiming the machine gun. The top of his head was gone, and it had rained that night, and rain had collected inside of his skull. And one of my buddies, we were sitting there on our helmets waiting to be pulled out off this little, small island off the coast of Peleliu that my battalion had hit. And we'd run into heavy resistance there, although the history books say it was light. That was because it was written by someone who wasn't up there. But anyway, we were waiting for an army infantry battalion that was going to relieve us. And we were just sitting around. It was fairly quiet. We were just sitting around waiting for the army guys to come up and relieve us, and sitting on our helmets. And they made a great bucket seat, you know. And this buddy of mine, I noticed he was just flipping chunks of coral, you know, little chunks of coral. And he was sitting about 3 feet away from this dead gunner and the dead Japanese laying all in amongst us. And he was trying to flip the little bits of pebble into the skull. And every time he'd get one in there, it'd be a little splash, you know. It reminded me of a child throwing pebbles into a puddle, you know, or something. And it was just so unreal. And of course, much of what it seems to me, much of what I experienced, and my buddies too, I mean, it was nothing unique about me, but what we experienced, much of it is never written about, because the guys, in most cases, the people who wrote came up to the front lines and spent a little while, and as anybody with any sense would, left as soon as they could, because the chances of not getting hit was so slim. That is, the two battles I was in.
Mm. And, you know, I'm thinking, gee, again, to come back to these young, ordinary, decent young kids who are very heroic, helping their buddies, and yet that war, that particular kind, does something. Or the kid who wanted to shoot the Japanese soldier's penis off.
Yeah. Well, just, and the thing that amazed me in retrospect is that it was so unreal, and you had all kinds of people come back from the service who had seen varying degrees of combat, people wouldn't believe most of that because it's just too bizarre.
Yeah.
And for instance, there's a section in With the Old Breed in which I describe when our company was on a hill called Half Moon Hill in Okinawa. It was right next to Sugarloaf Hill, which the 6th Marine Division had taken. And we were on Half Moon Hill about 10 days, I guess, and the Japs were on the other side of it. And every night, they'd try to come through the lines, and we'd have these grenade fights with them. They'd jump into foxholes and all this kind of stuff. We were under constant artillery and mortar fire, and there were no helicopters, of course, so our wounded had to be taken out probably 2 miles through the mud. And the dead couldn't be removed, and there were dead Japs there. We'd throw mud over them, and then the shells would come in and blow that off and blow them apart, and the maggots were just in the mud like you were in some piece of rotten corruption out there somewhere, or compost pile. Writers don't write about this, the journalists and so forth, because nobody came up there who didn't have to be there.
That it was different, that the Pacific theater, European theater, with attitudes toward the antagonist was different, that they were considered different than the Germans.
I think that's true. And I've heard many guys who fought in Europe say that, the Germans were damn good soldiers, and, we hated the hell out of having to fight them and this, that, and the other, but when they surrendered, sometimes you'd run into one who spoke English, and they were guys just like us.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Japanese, it was not that way. I don't really know, but about at Peleliu, I think, as I recall, my company took 2 prisoners. At Okinawa, we took about 5. Now, and you read accounts of so many prisoners taken on the Pacific battlefields. Well, when those prisoners, when they got them back and interrogated them, they found that many of them were Oriental laborers. They were not Japanese soldiers in most cases.
Mm.
And we had the orders not to, to kill the wounded or to try to take prisoners, because if they surrendered, they'd give you all the information
mm-hmm.
possible, And but the guys just, the feeling was so strong Now, you see, someone who was not in a frontline company, he would say, I didn't feel that way. Well, maybe he didn't, because maybe he could get a cup of coffee when he wanted it, and he could take a shower when he wanted it. He wasn't out there living like an animal or a savage, and knew that he had to stay up there until he got hit or killed, or until all of the enemy was done
mm-hmm.
away with.
Yeah. That drill instructor way back, even in the very beginning in boot camp.
Well, Terry Daugherty, bless his heart, he just died about it.
But I mean, what did he say? The drill instructor would say they were different, wouldn't he?
Yeah. He'd tell us, he'd say, you guys, you're not going to Europe to fight, you're going to the Pacific, and you better learn how to use this K-bar, because I guarantee you, either you or the guy next to you, before the war's over, you're going to be involved in a hand-to-hand fight with a kickball. And in my case, I personally never was, because fortunately my buddy, Snafu Shelton, old Merrill Shelton from Louisiana, either one or the other of us always managed to shoot those at night that got in very, very close. But sometimes just out of sheer fatigue, they would get close enough, and the guys wouldn't be able to see them or hear them until they jumped in, and then it was the K-bar,
What was that phrase? You both have a phrase. You're not going Asiatic on me. Going Asiatic.
Yeah, well, Asiatic is an old Marine term that people, you might say, define it different ways, but basically what it meant was you had just simply been in the Asian theater Well, it was a pre-war term, too. And a Marine had been on a Far Eastern station so long that he began to just kind of think differently from other people. Mm-hmm. He just came kind of sort of mentally detached, you know, from the way other people felt. And the thing that, of all the things to me that was so difficult to get over, other than the horror of it and the loss of my buddies and all, about the war was to come home and find people who complained about trivia and complained about things that, you know, you'd want to say, well, my God, you can go get a pair of dry socks on anytime you want to. You're not being shelled or shot at. And what are you complaining about? You know, that was one of the hardest things over the years to really learn to live with, that everybody hadn't had it the same way we had, you know. But by the same token, as my dad told me, don't ever feel sorry for yourself, because your outfit had it rough, as rough or rougher than anybody other than the prisoners of the Japs, but you survived, so don't feel sorry for
you
yourself.
You were what, how many of your original company?
Well, at Peleliu, we had 65% casualties. In Okinawa, we had over 100%. I guess in the two campaigns, the Gun Sergeant Hank Boys and I counted it up, and there were about 10 of us that never got a scratch, and I never missed a day of
That's
combat.
10 out of how many, would you say?
Well, you see, the company originally had 235 in it, but some went home after Peleliu, Guadalcanal veterans, and then some of the wounded came back to the company, and then you see at Okinawa, the company hit the beach with 235 men, and the landing was unopposed there, but we landed with 235 men, but then we got 250 replacements over the... They just kept feeding the new men into the company. And so it would be impossible to figure what the percentages were.
It's a very, obviously very few survived.
I mean, my luck was just almost unreal.
I was thinking, certain ones are more affected than others. I mean, more brutalized. War brutalizes. Because you're describing a scene in Okinawa, and that old woman, woman. And the young kid did it. She went, her suffering was so great.
Yeah, she was in this little hut, and had made the breakthrough there and had broken through the Naha Shuri line, it was called, the main Japanese defense line of defended ridges on the southern end. And we're moving forward there, and I had Snafu and I, he was the gun and I was the assistant gun on this light infantry mortar, but when we acted as riflemen, we swapped off with the Tommy gun, and he had a carbine, I had the Tommy, or we'd switch them off. And I had the Tommy gun, Thompson submachine gun, and I went to check this little house out. It was some of the little houses had grass, or thatched, like they used in medieval Europe, thatched roofs on Okinawa. Some of them had tile roof. And this small little house, and there was this old Okinawan woman in there. And she held out her hands like that, and many of the older Okinawans had an hourglass-shaped figure tattooed on the back of the hand, and apparently this meant that they were of Okinawan heritage. And she said, "No Nipponese," which meant she was not Japanese. Well, of course, we hadn't run into any Japanese civilians. We had only encountered Okinawan civilians. And she opened her kimono and pointed down to the area just at the lower part of her abdominal region on one side, and pointed with her finger, and it was this terrible healed up wound down there, and you could see the gangrene had set in, and she was sitting just inside the door, and there was enough daylight for me to see that wound, and you could see the gangrene there and everything, and you know, I knew that it was infected, and I knew enough to know that it was probably gotten into the body cavity, and you know, that's peritonitis sets in a case like that, and she probably didn't have a chance to survive, and she obviously was in terrible pain. She'd probably gotten caught in the artillery fire between the Japanese and the American forces is probably what injured her, or maybe an airstrike, and the wound was maybe a week or more old, but she just very gently reached around and got the muzzle of my Tommy gun and moved it around to her forehead, and then motioned with her other hand for me to pull the trigger. And I just jerked it away and motioned no to her and called a corpsman over there. I said, "Hey, Doc, there's an old good woman." This is what we call the natives in the Pacific. "There's an old good woman over here that's got a bad wound. Come check out and see if you can do anything." So he said, "Okay, sledgehammer." So he came running over there. Then by that time, he put a dressing on it. And he called to send word to the rear to have somebody evacuate the old woman. And when we weren't on any fire or anything at that particular time. So they said, some of the guys back there in the back said, "Okay, we'll come get her." And so this medical corpsman and I started moving on out. The sergeant said, "Come on, sledgehammer, let's go." So I started moving out, and we got, I don't know how far from the hut. It wasn't very far. And we heard a rifle shot ring out. Mm. And, of course, you recognize the different weapons. You had to learn to do that in a hurry, you know. And this corpsman and I both went down into a crouch, and I said, "That was an M1, wasn't it?" You know, M1 Grand Rifle.
Which is a more violent one, isn't it? An M1.
Yeah, violent. What do you mean?
No, M1 is... Oh, then you knew it was an American gun.
Yeah, that's right. I knew it was an American rifle. So we knew that a Marine had fired a shot. Mm-hmm. See, we could recognize the Japanese Arisaka rifle when it went off. And I said, "That was an M1. And the corpsman said, "It sure was." And we looked back toward the hut and thought, "My God, you know, maybe there was a sniper in there that we didn't see. And maybe that old woman was acting as a front for him or something." Well, here comes one of the guys in the company walking out, checking safety on his rifle. And we went back over there and said, I said, "Was there a nip in that hut?" And he said, "No, there was just an old gook woman in there. And she wanted me to put her out of her misery so she could join her ancestors, I guess. And so I obliged her." And I just blew my top. I said, "You son of a bitch, they didn't send us out here to kill old women. They sent us out here to fight the Japs." And he started making all these excuses, you know, and all this. And I said, and the corpsman jumped in and started reaming him out. And about that time, the sergeant came up and said, "What the hell's going on, you guys?" And so we told him. And he said, "Okay, you guys move out." So we went on, and I don't know what was ever done about it, whether it was any disciplinary action or what. But, just the utter... I mean, that shocked most of the guys I knew. And I told this guy, I said, you know, he was back in company headquarters, which was, considering the overall picture, was pretty far forward, you know. I mean, he was no more than maybe 50 yards behind the front line. I said, "My God, if you want to kill somebody and shoot somebody, you come up here with us and stay with us. Don't you stay back into company CP."
What is it then that made you behave differently, say, from this guy? I mean, what? Now it becomes little things, individual difference, don't we? Something you would never dream of doing, he did. You know, something he wasn't horrified by, you were horrified by. What? I guess individuals were different there, too, I suppose.
Well, I guess so, because he was a nice... I mean, he was a good buddy, and he was a nice guy, and I liked him.
That's what I'm talking about. Now, something... These were all pretty good kids, weren't they?
Oh, hell yeah.
Sure, now and then you find a sadist or a crazy nut.
That's true.
You mentioned a certain nut there.
But generally speaking,
these are just ordinary kids.
Well, they were ordinary in a sense. They were, in a sense, like the boy next door. But in a sense, to me, they were extraordinary because our outfit was fantastic. I mean, they were... Most of them didn't wait to be drafted. They volunteered, and they weren't just a bunch of hot-headed, crazy kids. They joined up because they wanted to belong to what was the best, and I think that's what happened.
No, I mean, what makes them these good kids, decent and patriotic? What makes them, after a time, do and accept these horrible things? War itself, is what I mean.
Well, I don't know. I mean, nobody knows the answer to that, but I think most people have no concept of what war is really like at the elemental level of the man who's out there looking at the enemy over the sights of a rifle. And I mean, I don't mean this this movie, macho business of dashing in for an exciting 24-hour raid and all that stuff. I'm talking about day after day after day being pounded with artillery, being pounded with mortars, seeing guys get killed, that you literally love these guys, you're so close to them, and they have risked their lives for you and vice versa. And because what you're trying to do is survive mm-hmm. until it's over. Mm-hmm. And as to why one individual would act differently from another, I don't really know. This guy was a newer replacement than I. Mm-hmm. I was already a veteran of Peleliu when this happened, and he had come in just before Okinawa. But there was another incident where that I always thought was rather strange from the standpoint of the effects of the war on people. And I think it brought out how it was fighting the Japanese. The campaign was almost over at Okinawa, and we were out on a patrol in this fairly quiet area, and then rain had finally stopped. It rained just torrential rains for about 2 weeks, and we'd finally dried out. Literally bailed our foxholes out. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would literally fill up with water if you didn't bail them out. And if you got outside of them, you got hit or killed from shellfire. But anyway, we ran across this place that had been apparently a field hospital. And one of my buddies found this emaciated, wounded Japanese soldier lying in this bunk just inside, because you wouldn't dare go in beyond where the daylight was, because there might be snipers in there. Now, at Peleliu, the caves were all in coral ridges, but at Okinawa, it was clay. There was some rock, but this was a clay ridge, and it was reinforced with beams of wood and concrete, this cave was. And so this buddy of mine, he had a pistol and a 45 automatic, and he saw that the Jap apparently didn't have on anything but a G-string, and was just looked like he didn't maybe weigh over at least maybe 90 or 100 pounds, you know. He lost somebody. He was pitiful. He apparently had been wounded in the chest or something. But anyway, this friend, and when the Japs moved out, they'd left him behind. And this buddy of mine picked him up and carried him out, and everything was muddy out there. There was no place to put him except just lay him down on the mud. So he lay him down on the mud, and this Jap was very quiet and docile. He acted like he wasn't going to hurt anybody. And so John, this boy, laid him down out there, and we were all sitting off there about, I guess, 20, 30 feet, and sitting on our helmets, you know, waiting for a corpsman to come up and check this chap wounded out, because information might be able to be obtained from him by the intelligence section. And so John was looking around. He was just sort of daydreaming, and this wounded Jap was lying there on the ground. We figured he couldn't get up. And the Japanese grenade, an incident, see how ours had
there it is.
Yeah, well, now, this is an American grenade. You see, he had to pull the pin mm-hmm. and then let that spoon fly off. Or when you wow. threw it, the spoon flew off, and you had a cap, a hammer that hit the cap. Well, the Japanese grenade was different. You pulled the pin on it, and then you had to hit it on something hard mm-hmm. to pop the cap, to set the powder train. And they typically would hit it on the rifle stock, or I've seen them hit it on the helmet. Mm. Well, we looked over there, and here was this wounded Japanese. He had reached down in his G-string. He had a grenade out. He jacked the pin out of it, and he didn't have anything to hit it on, so he was hitting it on his fist to try to pop the cap, and then he was going to literally... Well, it would have made hamburger meat out of both him and John, you see. And so we yelled over there and said, "Look out there, buddy. That Nip's got a grenade." And John looked down there at him and said, "Well, you son of a bitch, if that's the way you feel about it." So he just pulled his 45 out and shot him right between the eyes. And so then the corpsman came up, and a lieutenant came up and said, "Where's this wounded Nip?" And we said, "Well, he's dead now. He's over." And he said, "Well, who shot him and why? And if he, did he surrender?" And we said, "Yes, sir." But he didn't say so on the front lines. Officers had code names. We said, "Yeah, he surrendered, but he tried to pull a grenade on John, so John shot him." But now, see, here was this guy who had compassion enough to go in and get this Japanese out of the bunk where he was right inside the cave and bring him out there to try to get medical help for him. And then the reaction of the Japanese soldier was to try to pull a grenade to kill them both, he said. So this show, this is, my point is, this is what we were up against.
Right, right. You said there were very few. We know in Europe there were a great many self-inflicted wounds, had to be. Same in the Asiatic theater?
Well, no, I don't know about the Asiatic theater. I'm talking about I'm talking about in my outfit. I'm not making any general statements, but I don't know of any. I've talked to some of the guys that survived since the war, and they laugh about the fact that, you know, when there would be heavy fire, sometimes they'd want to stick the hand, one finger up, maybe it would get hit, you know, so they could get evacuated. But there was always that stigma of not letting your buddies down.
That's the thing, isn't that interesting? That happened, a guy told me about this in European theater, too. He was being honored. He says, oh, they should know. I wanted to do it, but I just couldn't let my buddies down.
Let me
turn this over. This is beautiful.
Well, I don't know what you...
So that's the end of part one. As Studs Terkel flips over the tape, and you'll hear part two of that tomorrow. But I think what you get is a sense of just what a great what a great guy Gene Sledge was. And so, amazing. Yeah, I found that over the weekend. And that's why I say, you know, you hear guys talk. And I think that Gene Sledge would love to talk about, you know, how do you go on after that? You know, because, you know, he writes so much about the experience and writing about it was the way that you coped with it. William Manchester, Goodbye Darkness, right? You know, I mean, the title says everything. You know, as he went back and revisited the places that he fought later in his life. And to try to do something with this. So anyway, I think that I would have loved to have a conversation with him. Anyway, that'll do it on a Monday. Yeah, no, I don't know. I'm a geek about stuff like that. An unapologetic geek about stuff like that. And so, you know, Studs Terkel has this gift. You know, he's of the common man, and that's what, you know, he does in Chicago. I mean, when you look at the things that Studs Terkel writes about, you know, it's working class people, and it's the normal aspects of life. So, yeah, very, very cool stuff. On a Monday, All Marine Radio, out.